Hey everybody, it's Operation Tango Romeo, the place where healing happens. If you'd like to support this show, remember, like, comment, subscribe, and share like the sugar bear, because sharing is caring. Hello all you beautiful souls, thank you for joining me for another very important edition of Operation Tango Romeo, the Trauma Recovery Podcast for veterans, first responders, and their families. Now, I've covered a lot of different topics on the show, and sometimes I talk about veterans affairs. After 300, and this is the 303rd episode, I have never had anybody from veterans affairs on the show to talk about what it's like to work there and the work that they do. I've invited them numerous times, and I've invited the Veterans Ombudsman several times. They said they'd be on the show, but then they've just never shown up. I've invited Minister McCauley on the show, and he doesn't want to show up. Isn't that something? Because I can get everybody else here on the show. I've had the Premier of Alberta, the Shadow Minister of Veterans Affairs, numerous MPs. But I can't get Veterans Affairs on the show, nor the Legion for that matter. Everybody else and their dog, celebrities, everything else, but not the people that are actually providing the government supplied services. And that's a little bit telling all by itself. Today, this is a really important show. I have on here my dear friend, Tom Anderson, who I served with in PPCLI, first in the 3rd Battalion in Victoria, Esquimalt actually, and then the 1st Battalion in Calgary. My first and only tour was Tom's second tour. And 1 week into that tour, he lost his legs in April 1994. It shook all of us up. And when I first saw the wreckage, which Tom posts a picture of the records every year in April as a reminder. But when I saw it in person the first time, I can't even begin to describe how that shook us. And it was absolutely miraculous. God loves Tom Anderson because really there's no way he should be here. Anybody that's seen the wreckage, the entire front end of the ILTIS, for our non-Canadian audience, just call it an army jeep, it was gone. Even the engine block was torn right out. There was nothing there. And yet, Tom did survive. Tom, thanks for being here, brother.
Thank you very much, Merrick. It's a pleasure and honor to be on your show, finally.
Well, it's good to have you, man. And honestly, I was a little bit hesitant a year or two ago when we first started talking about it, because I just wanted to see how things played out with Veterans Affairs, but really they've been playing out for 29 years for you. And it's funny, the first sort of example of the system failing you was when you were still in the hospital, when you first lost your legs, and you don't even remember the words that were said to you, but they went around the battalion and everybody was told that RSM cable gun looked at you and he says, so what do you want us to do with your boots? And you said that you didn't even remember that being said to you, but that's that story, true or not, is true. Yeah, yeah. It's true of the environment.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic, funny that you brought that up, because I was down in St. John's a few weeks ago to see Don Gibbert, Mike Bill, and another guy. A
couple of legends there.
Yeah, for sure. So anyway, Mike Bill brought it up.
The same thing.
Same thing that you said, you know, Tommy Anderson's being looked after, yada, yada, yada. It's like, whatever. Just to give you an idea, Mark, excuse me. When I first had my accident, or I should say my landmine explosion, I was 10 years before the government compensated me for my injuries.
Ten years. How did you survive for those 10 years?
Yes, you heard me correctly. 10 friggin' years before I compensated. So I picked up the phone and, called VAC, Veterans Affairs Canada, and asked them why I did not get compensated for my injuries, April 24, 1994. And the response that I got back was that I was not entitled to no compensation because, get this now, I was not in a war-torn country. I was not in a, honest to God, I was not in actual theater of combat. Yeah. That is the honest to God truth.
Oh, my God.
I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, because they have landmines on the beach in Cancun.
Yeah, I
oh,
I
my couldn't, God.
And, like I said, are you guys for real? Here I am, you know, member of the department, working for Department of National Defense. Got half blown up on the job. And you guys are telling me that I don't deserve no compensation. But anyway, through all the pigs and reels...
Tom, I think somebody turned on that fan again.
No, that's my water pump going.
Oh, okay. It's all right. We'll push through it.
Oh, okay, it's gone. So anyway, it was 10 years later down the road before they finally woke up and said, yeah, we're going to compensate you now.
So that's 20 years.
10 years.
Okay, so 10 years. Yeah. Oh, but that was why. Okay, so there wasn't another 10 years on top of that. I'm with you.
No, it was 10 years. And
I got to translate for the audience that doesn't know. So Croatia was a civil war. And to say it's not a war-torn country, it was a genocide, for God's sakes. Entire villages were bombed and leveled to the floor. Tens of thousands of men, women, and children were slaughtered. Landmine strikes. 1 year before Roto 4 was the Battle of Medek Pocket, the biggest battle since Korea. I mean, for some bureaucrat with their head up their ass, not understanding that because it was a UN peacekeeping mission doesn't mean it wasn't a combat mission. It was absolutely a combat mission. But because it was a UN peacekeeping mission, this bureaucrat who had absolutely no idea decided that Tom losing his legs to a landmine wasn't a war injury.
According to the United Nations Tribunal Council a few years back, they claimed that there was no genocide that took place over in the Balkans, which is totally crap. Yeah. You know the difference. I know the difference. We've seen it with our own eyes.
They've been trying to downplay it since, like, when it was happening. Like, they called it ethnic cleansing. That's a bullshit word that they just invented so that they don't admit that there was a genocide. It's like they're just playing word games so that they don't admit that it was a genocide. I don't understand it.
No, me either. And I still don't understand it. And the way that the government is treating myself, not only myself, I know there is a lot more veterans besides myself that are getting put through the ringer, mm-hmm. way Blue Cross and... DVA, Treat Your Veterans, and I could remember vividly quite well when Mr. Justin Trudeau got elected as our prime minister. He came on national television and he said that no veteran will, you know, the government will not go to court fighting against veterans. Yeah. But how come there's so many lawsuits on the go?
Well, that's it. Several. Let's hop into the comments here. Carl Gustafson, that's Brendan Gorham is his real name. He says, VAC and the government of Canada doesn't want to move from an SDA. What's an SDA? to an actual theater of war, because it would mean the government has to take care of the injured veterans. Oh, that's why.
Yeah. But I mean, there's a big difference, Mark. You know as well as I do. There is a big difference in maintaining peace and trying to make peace. No, I was not involved in any contact, you know, firefights. But if I remember correctly, C Company was involved in a, you know, a tough situation, in a firefight in Medic Pocket, I do believe.
It took me a long time, Tom, before I considered myself a combat veteran because of that tour. But I mean, I was shot. We were all shot at least a little, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And if nothing else, we were surrounded by landmines. And I mean, think about some of the patrols that would happen. I mean, you had a whole tour before that, which we'll talk about in a bit. But on this tour, we were doing some hairy, hairy shit. Like 2-person patrols at 3 a.m. behind SIR blinds. Like, that's insane. Nobody in Afghanistan would have done a 2-person patrol in a hostile area without support. I mean, it was suicidal, but that's what we did.
And,
you know, had it hit the fan and it got hairy more than a couple of times. There was no support. Like, we're just dead meat because there's only 2 of us. Didn't matter how we were armed. They had guns too.
Do you, can you remember the time when there was a little small yellow car hijacked? I call it the Mr. Bean car. Actually, I still got a photo on my phone. And I was sat down in the modular tenting, sat down on my cot, writing a letter back home to my mom and dad saying, you know, everything's going good and haven't seen much action yet. Everything's pretty quiet. And all of a sudden, I heard machine gun fire. I dropped everything I was doing because we were on standby for that entire day. I ran to the platoon headquarters. My sergeant, my commander was Sergeant John McKenzie. So we had to man up and go down the road in the carrier. In the M113 carriers, and I think it was only like just over a kilometer down from our platoon headquarters. So when we pulled up, there was a small car, 4 males in the car. The guy in front was dead, and the other guy in the back was dead, and the car was like a spaghetti strainer with bullet holes.
Yeah,
and these were just 4 ordinary civilians, probably just got off work, going back home to their families.
Is that your first tour or Rota 4?
That was, let me think, that was the first tour.
Yeah.
So when we drove up to the scene, you know, my heart was in my throat. It was pounding. And it's like, this is real. This is real stuff going on here.
Yeah.
So anyway, through all the jigs and reels that night, we had to do a vehicle patrolling all night with the NVGs. And while we were traveling down this road, I seen a silhouette of a man on top of a rooftop. So I called it in on intercom to Sergeant John McKenzie. I told him about it. So we turned the carrier around up the road a couple of kilometers, and we had to do a dismounted patrol. And I remember John saying, take extra ammo, just in case. So we did a foot patrol, complete darkness, walking in the ditch of the roads, walking around buildings. You didn't know if you was going to get stepped on any personnel mine or landmine or whatever. And I said to John McKenzie, this is the house where I seen a silhouette of a man. So we stayed there for a bit, and John called it off because we didn't know if we were walking to an ambush. There could have been 15, 20 Serbians in that house. We don't know. So John called over the radio and got another carrier come down, pick up our section, and take us back to our carrier. And then we abandoned the little mission and came back to our platoon headquarters. But like you said, it was, very stressful, you know, moments. You didn't know if you were going to come out of it alive or dead. So
let's roll back the clock a little bit. When you left home to join the Army, you really left home. You went from coast to coast, went from Newfoundland to the West Coast. Because the third battalion was in Esquimalt. So a lot of Newfoundlanders, they join the Army for economic reasons. Some do because of their family heritage, because there's a military heritage. When you decided to join, what was the driver for you, Tom?
I was always fascinated with the military way of life. I'm interested in, you know, rifles and guns, all that sort of stuff, you know, camping in the woods. And actually, what enticed me to join the military is I watched that movie Platoon. I don't know if you watched that movie before, but right at the end of the movie, Buddy was on his knees and he held his arms up. And the chopper took off and left him there. And the Vietnamese shot him down. I don't know, but for some reason, that movie sticks into my head. And I always wanted to wear the Canadian uniform. And so that's what I did. Joined the military.
What year did you get in?
It was November the 8th, 1990. Is my enrollment date.
So just a year before me.
Yeah, and I have nobody in my family got any military background. I got cousins that was in military too, but nobody in my family have any military background. But ever since I was a young boy, I always wanted to join the Army, and that's what I did.
So why infantry? Out of all the things you could have done, what was the driver for you?
Well, like I said, I like shooting off rifles. You know, watching movies where, you know, seeing guys, you know, shooting off bazookas, rocket launchers. I was really enticed by that. And I just had a keen interest in that sort of thing. And that's what motivated me to join the military.
So if you're going to do it, you're going to do it all the way. Now, you had other choices. If you had chosen the RCR, the Royal Canadian Regiment, you would have been a lot closer to home, cheaper flights. So why did you choose the Patricias instead of the Royals?
I wanted to join RCRs because RCRs are considered to be the armies of the East because all the postings is on the East Coast. So obviously I'm a Newfoundlander, so I would be closer to home. Shout out, Doug. So anyway, I remember one day when we graduated from Cornwallis and he said, okay, you're going RCR, you're going PBCLI. And the training sergeant said, you're going PBCLI. And I said, Jesus, I want to go RCR. He said, you're going fucking PBCLI. So off I went.
And that was after basic training. I knew that I was going to be a Patricia right from before I shipped out to Cornwallis.
I did not know. Till the last minute, they said, you're going PBCLI. And I was like, geez, I want it. but in saying that, it worked out to be, I think it was a good move because, I mean, I'm very proud of, you know, the regiment that I served with and plus also the battalion, the 3rd Battalion. And, of course, we were first in the field, so we got better bragging rights there.
Well, the 3rd at that time, I mean, we won the award for the most physically fit unit in the country, which means we were more fit than the airborne. It was something else. Kenward pushed us hard.
Talking about being most physically fit, the most physically fit soldier that I was introduced to was Gordy Machine Gun Glenn, and I think he was 40. He was 42 years old when he joined the fucking infantry. 42 years old.
So we got to talk about Gordy a little bit.
And he was able to outrun all of us, and we were all, you know, 18, 19 years old, full of piss and vinegar, and he was in top of his shape, and he put us young guys to shame, actually.
Well, Gordy was the nicest guy. Everybody loved him. And he was he actually played in the NHL. He had a few games in the NHL anyway, and then WHL. Yes. But there was a documentary about hockey tough guys, and he was in it.
Until he knocked out Ari Neal, then his career was over with.
Yeah, when he knocked out his coach.
Yeah, too funny.
Are you still in touch with Gordy?
Oh, yes, actually. I was talking to Gordy when I was down in St. John's, Newfoundland, when Mike Bell and he came down to see me. So we were having a few beers and then slopped up. And so anyway, but hey, let's call Gordy Glenn. So we had Gordy on the phone. Oh, Jesus, must have been about an hour, I guess. And actually, we couldn't get him off the phone because he was, you know, he was very happy to hear from us. So we were, you know, talking about old good old days.
And, well, make sure you send this to him. I doubt highly that he remembers me, but everybody remembers Gordy because, you know, how many NHL players. And plus, he was in his early 40s when he went through battle school. But everybody loved him, you know. Everybody loved Gordy Glenn.
Yeah. Gordy Glenn is a great individual. He's a good buddy of mine, and he's actually living in an apartment in, I think it's Shediac, New Brunswick. I think the Legion built some apartments there for homeless vets, and Gordy Glenn is one of the guys that's in these apartments, and he's doing pretty good for himself.
Didn't he get burnt in a fire?
Yes, I think he had some third-degree burns. He was driving this car one night, and when he was driving past this house, he noticed this house was on fire. He stopped, got out of his car, went in, and saved the whole family.
That's not surprising.
And if it wasn't for Gordy Glenn, these people would have been dead. But good old Gordy, PPCLI guy.
Yeah, that's right.
Rushed in and saved them.
Well, and those I don't know if he
ever received recognition for that, but to me, Gordy Glenn should have received recognition for that.
When that there's a couple of murderers running around Saskatchewan, killing people left and right, and with knives, yeah. And it was a Patricia that stepped up, and unfortunately, he didn't survive. He succumbed to the knife wounds.
Yes, I know. It's very sad. I didn't even know this Patricia. And, you know, when I heard it on the news, you know, it triggered me. And
yeah,
I shed a few tears for that Patricia.
It's the training, and it's probably who we were before we joined. I mean, not everybody is going to join the infantry. That's an all-in move. You know,
exactly.
It takes some courage just to sign that line.
I got a friend of mine. He joined the military before I did, and he was RCR. So every now and then he used to, you know, send me a letter saying, you know, I'm up 5 o'clock in the morning doing a rucksack march and all this old shit. And I'm like, I'm not fucking doing that no more, are you? You know, so, and at the time I was only young. My parents couldn't afford, you know, give me $20 or whatever, you know, enjoy the night for the week and go get a case of beer. So I picked up the phone and phoned back, and I said, you know, is this job offer still open for infantry? And the lady said, yep. I said, okay, I'll take it. And a couple of days after that, I got off the bus in Cornwallis, and this big, tall sergeant, Rob McDonald at the time.
I remember him.
With the pay stick.
Well, he was a sergeant, then a master corporal, then a sergeant again, then a master corporal again. He had a Velcro chevron.
And he started screeching, going, all right, lift, right, march back to the barracks. And this is just when we got off the bus, and I'm like, what the hell did I get myself into here? But you know what? In saying that, I had a great experience in the military. I met a lot of good men and women that I consider my brothers and sisters, and I know they would take a bullet for me, and likewise, I would take a bullet for them. And best friends forever. I met a lot of good people.
We got in the comments here, Arnold Murphy, thanks for that. The name of the Patricia that that passed away because he intervened with the stabbing massacre. His name is Earl Burns.
Earl Burns, yes, that's his name, yeah.
Earl Burns. Thank you so much, Arnold Murphy, for throwing that in the comment section here so that we can say his name as it should be said.
Yeah, rest in peace, old buddy.
Rest in peace, brother. VP.
Yeah, that was a sad, sad tragedy. Too sad.
Too sad. So when you're on the West Coast, you must have been some homesick, or did it help that we were on the ocean?
Actually, yeah, I was homesick, but being close to the ocean because the marina was right there, I found that helped a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what? Well, I was single at the time, and the nightlife out there was pretty good too.
Yeah, being a single young soldier in Victoria was pretty good.
Yeah. Just that we didn't get along with the Navy guys lots of times.
Yeah, I was just saying.
All in good fun.
I just saying to my boys, out of all the bar scraps I got in then, it was never with a Navy guy. Like, oh, come on, I wanted to scrap a Navy guy. But that never happened for me.
Yeah. But, I mean, I had, a lot of good memories out in Work Point Barracks and I want to go back again, just to see the place again, just for a bit of closure, I guess.
I was there last year with my wife. We went to an Airbnb on Fantan Alley. So Fantan Alley is kind of a famous alley. It's been in the movie A Bird on the Wire with Mel Gibson. And when we were there, Tom, downtown Victoria was gorgeous. Like, it was a beautiful, beautiful spot.
It's a beautiful.
It ain't. No more. It's all the charm, the beauty is gone. It's
really.
When I was there, I was so damn hyper vigilant because there's horrible addiction problems, and it's not like when we were there, the homeless folk were just kind of like buskers and just kind of friendly, healthy, but homeless. Or they're traveling, or they're hitchhikers. Well, now there's giant camps, like hundreds of people there in tents and on just the worst kind of drugs. I actually watched a guy die on the street, while the paramedics were working on him. I was like, well, that was his last breath. He's dead. And
out of drugs?
Yeah, drugs and, drugs is just the symptom of trauma. So all these traumatized people who are turning to drugs because it's all that they have to turn to, it's just so sad. And you certainly don't feel safe. Like the hypervigilance was off the charts after the first few days.
But then the thing is, too, like you go up Halifax or wherever the case may be, St. John's, Vancouver, and especially Vancouver is very, very bad for drug addicts. Yeah. And you look at these people, and you got to realize that, they got a problem, mental health issues, drug issues, and lots of times there's no compassion for these people, but these are somebody's uncle, cousin, brother, son, sister.
Well, there's a hell of a lot of veterans on the streets, Tom, and like a hell of a lot. And like, thank God, if we were injured because of our service, we have, it's tough to access it, but we have Veterans Affairs. You know, I'm living off of veterans benefits. I'm not ashamed to say it.
It's sometimes. That's the thing. Mm-hmm.
But if there were resources available to anybody that needs them, for mental health services and whatnot, there wouldn't be a homeless problem. Like it wouldn't be an issue, because everybody who is homeless for more than say 6 months, because sometimes shit just happens no matter who you are, and nobody's immune from it. But the trauma injuries that translate into drug addiction and what we see on the streets, that's all treatable. Where the majority of it is treatable.
It is.
And I know it is because mean, I'm still alive. It's how I know it's true. You know, if it wasn't treatable, I wouldn't be alive anymore. I would have been dead a couple of years ago. But I'm still here. And because healing does happen. But veterans, we are lucky that we have, as difficult as it is to access the resources, at least there are some resources there. You know,
yes.
Whereas for the general public, that's just not so. And it's also not so for police and first responders. They don't have what we have for access. The RCMP is a bit better because they have Veterans Affairs. But you and I, and we'll get into that, Veterans Affairs has the programs and it has the help. It's accessing the help that's the issue. You know, it's behind so many firewalls. You got to jump through so many damned hoops to get help. It's unbelievable. It's predatory.
Tell me about it. I mean, I'm a prime example. I got injured April 24th, 1994. It's almost 30 years ago. And I'm still fighting through the loops pertaining Blue Cross and Veterans Affairs Canada when it comes to, you know, trying to get my health-related travel forms, my trips, you know, pre-approved for my medical appointments, and most of them are service-related. And I know exactly what you're going through and what other people are going through. And I imagine that there are still a lot of veterans that are just getting pushed aside. And it's totally wrong. And
so let's talk about that day, if you're able to.
Sure.
So April 1994, we're in, if it's not the most heavily mined area in the world, it's top three for sure. Landmines, yeah. Absolutely everywhere. You're driving an Iltis. An Iltis, again, it's an army Jeep, and not a great one.
It's a soft skin vehicle.
Yeah. Did you have the ballistic blankets on the floor?
No.
Didn't even have that.
No. Since you brought that up, the only top brass military member that came to the National Defense Medical Center during my rehabilitation. Do you know who he was?
I do not.
Major General Lewis McKenzie.
So Lou showed up.
Yes, sir. And I was very impressed by Lewis McKenzie. And when he came in, Mark, that was the question that he asked me. He said, Corporal Tommy Anderson, he said, I got a question to ask you. I said, what's that, sir? He said, do you think it would make a difference if they had blast blankets put on the floor of my Iltis? And my response to him was, not a chance. Not a chance in hell. He said, good enough. He said, that's what I wanted to hear. He said, I just had to ask you that question. So
yeah. Well, I mean, it was such a – it must have been an anti-tank mine, you know.
I think it was called a TMA-3 landmine.
I don't know how they would know after it blows up, and it couldn't have been a TMA-3 because
I don't know, but that's what I've been heard.
Oh, TMA-3, right? I was thinking PMA-3, which is the hockey puck. It's like, well, it wasn't the hockey puck.
T as in Tommy.
Yeah, yeah. So tank, an anti-tank mine. Yeah.
Yeah. So, cool. Yeah, did you? I just lost my train of thought there. Did you said you wanted to ask me about the day?
So that day you're in the Iltis, and who was sitting next to you?
My platoon commander, Lieutenant Chris Lunny.
Okay. And do you remember where you were off to, or what was you guys were doing?
Oh Jesus, we were. We went to clear mines. Well, not clear the landmines. The engineers, they wanted to clear this dirt road, which was already cleared before. So they want to go it one more time to make sure that this dirt road was free of landmines to one of our OPs. So it was a beautiful sunny day. We were stopped for our lunch break. And I can't remember if it was the sergeant or warrant or whatever. Asked me if I could take the Eltis and drive down to the next checkpoint because we had the interpreter with us, and she was a female, and she wanted to use the washroom. I said, yeah, I said, not a problem. So me and her jumped in the Eltis. I remember driving down this dirt road, went past a turn, and I had to pull out around this dead horse or cow. So anyway, stopped at the next checkpoint. She went and used the washroom. I waited for her. She came out, jumped in the Jeep. We came back the same road that we just traveled down. Came back, finished up our lunch, and we continued on down this road in a convoy. And I think I was the third or fourth vehicle in the convoy. And all of a sudden, boom, I knew exactly what happened. And I remember all the chaos. And I remember the guys, I could hear the guys saying, where the fuck is Anderson to? Where is Anderson? So I guess the lift tower of my Iltis detonated the landmine. I never had a seatbelt on. So the Eltis done somersaults in the air. And I guess I was ejected from the Eltis, probably like 100 or so meters away. And the guys found me in the ditch of the road amongst, you know, a bunch of thorn bushes. So they came over, and I remember them putting me on the fucking stretcher. One of my arms was dangling out over the stretcher. And I guess my arm must have got caught into one of the doors, I guess, through our chaos. And I remember telling the guys, I said, Jesus Christ, don't tear me fucking arm off, you know. And good old Lockhart Demolitor, he jumped in back of the ambulance with the medic and helped the medic do first aid on me. And I knew my legs were gone. I couldn't, you know, feel nothing from the waist below. And I still had enough strength. I used to try to sit up and see if I can see my legs. Demolitor, he used to put his hand on my chest and lay me back down. He said, no, that's okay, Tommy. He said, lay down and take it easy. And, you know, us guys, we got a sick sense of humor, I guess, so to speak. And I said to Demo, how do I look? And his exact words were, he said, tell you the truth, Tommy. He said, you kind of look like shit. Honest to God, I'll remember it till the day that I die. And two of us had a little chuckle about that. So anyway, they took me, they continued on down this dirt road to the nearest Croatian hospital, where they finished, snipped off my legs. They were only hamburger meat anyway. So they took me to the nearest Croatian hospital, finished taking my legs off, done surgery and that. Patch me up. And the last thing I could remember, excuse me, is I can remember the guys wheeling me across the tarmac on the stretcher. I could hear the helicopter blades going around. And all of a sudden, the helicopter blades disappeared. I could hear no sound, and I went unconscious. So I spent 10 days, I think, something like that, on the airport strip in Zagreb. and a medical team from San Diego looked out to me, cared for me while I was in the MASH unit. So I spent about 10 days there till they got me stabilized. Once they got me stabilized, they put me on board of the C-130 Herc and flew me to the National Defense Medical Center in Ottawa, Ontario. And I'd done about 6 months of rehabilitation. And once I finished my rehab, they posted me back to the Royal Newfoundland Regiment here on the island of Newfoundland, Labrador. So they pretty much put me on sick leave for like a year and a half till my release date. So it was
mandatory release then? You didn't have a choice?
That's what they said. Well, it was no other choice. They gave me a 3B medical release. They said that due to my injuries, I was no longer capable of doing, you know, performing my duties as an infantry soldier. And yeah, I questioned it. I said, well, can you get me like a, you know, an office job or something? And they said, no, that if it comes to wartime, everybody has to be physically fit to be called upon. So they said there was no other option but to.
So they didn't offer a remuster to another trade or anything?
No, no. So they gave me a 3B medical release. You know, what pisses me off is that we all put 100% into our jobs, Mark, as peacekeepers, as soldiers. And, you know, we all put our lives on the line in harm's way. I got half blown up. I'm still fortunate that I'm alive here talking to you. But, you know, we had some casualties over in the Balkans. Not a lot, but one is too many. I think we had like 7 or 8 casualties altogether over in Croatia, which is too many. So I was still fortunate enough to come back, not in a body bag. But the way the government has treated me over the years, there's lots of times that I wish that that landmine would have killed me, way I've been treated like shit over the years. So,
what's your first memory of feeling like they're treating you like shit?
Well, when I first came home and they said I wasn't entitled to no compensation. That was a real kick in the guts, you know. I put my life in harm's way, you know, got half blown up. I mean, I was a good soldier like you were. We all were good soldiers. Sometimes we worked around the clock, doing whatever, putting our life on the line. But I found out the hard way, because when you get injured, in my honest opinion, you're just a number on the computer. You're considered a waste of rations. You're no more good to us, so we got to get rid of you. Just like a horse, like a racehorse. If a horse breaks its leg, what do they do? We got to put doors down. And that's exactly how I fucking feel towards the government. I can't help it.
So how did you survive, Tom? When, because if you got out within a couple of years after the mine strike, and there was no compensation, there's still a few years to go before that 10 years is up. How did you survive during all those years?
Well, they gave me my pension, so I was able to, you know, live off of that.
Okay, so you had a monthly corporate. You had, so was the pension, was it a percentage of corporal's wages? Or was it full corporal's wages?
No, I'm not sure, Mark. That's a good question, because when I got injured, I was a private.
Okay.
Before I left to come home, I had two young Air Force WAGs come to the National Defense Medical Center, and they presented me with my chevrons for corporal, but it didn't mean a roll of beans to me anymore anyway, because I knew my career was done.
Yeah, but it's a big, that's the big pay jump, though. When you go from private three to corporal, that's a giant pay jump. And yeah. I'm getting paid according to rank. I was a corporal for all of 6 months, but because of that, I actually have a living income. You know, had I not, if I was on private three, I'd have to be working on the side.
Yeah. So, that's a good question. I don't know if my pension is based on corporal's pay when I got released or if it's based on private's pay. A few years back in 2014, I think it was, I was a part of the Leave No Vet Behind campaign, and it was one of the biggest major lawsuits in Canadian history. This lawsuit was about the DVA, of course, clawing back veterans' pensions, and I was a part of that lawsuit, and I think it cost the government like $789 million, something like that.
So, what were they clawing back? Like, they wanted you to pay back some of your monthly living allowance?
Yeah, well, I had a letter from come back from CISL one time years ago when I after I came home. And
what's CISL?
What is CISL?
Yeah.
Service Income Security Insurance Program, which is administered by Manulife.
Okay.
So after I came home, after like a year or so, a couple of years, I got a job down at Marine Atlantic Ferry Service as a commissioner doing security. So I came home one day, checked the mail, and I had a letter from CISL saying that I owed them $17,235, to be exact, because they said that any DVA benefits that I received was supposed to be offsetted against my LTD. So I picked up the phone and I called CISL and I said, listen, I said, I don't owe you guys jack shit. And the lady said, what do you mean? I said, my military pension, my DVA pension, I said, it's a disability pension. I said, it's tax-free money. Revenue Canada doesn't even consider it as a source of income. So I said, my DVA pension has nothing to do with my long-term disability. So I said, you guys are getting nothing from me. So anyway, when 2014 came around, I was involved with this lawsuit, and back then, Mark, I was getting $400 a month from CISL before this lawsuit. After this lawsuit was finalized, my LTD, my long-term disability from CISL, increased from $400 a month to like I think it's like almost $4,000 a month. Now, the LTD is taxable. So time of taxes is taken out, I think I clear, like, say, $3,200 a month from my LTD. And, of course, as you know, LTD is taxable. So that was a big major increase, going from $400 to, like, almost $4,000 a month. So once again, I picked up the phone. I called CISL, and because I said to them, like, this is a big increase. Like, are you sure? You know, you guys never made a mistake, because I don't want to take this check and cash it, and then probably a couple months down the road, you guys call me back and saying, you know, we made a mistake and you got to owe us back the money. The lady said, no, that's what you will be getting for the rest of your life till I die. So even to this date, that's what I get now. It's like $3,200-$3,400 clear a month. So I went from $400 to like $3,400 a month with my LTD until I turn 65. And then it's like you get 90% of the 70% of your top up.
I think you're still getting I think you're still getting underpaid. We'll talk about that.
Because right now, like
off air, there's I got friends at the Veterans Association. So in Calgary, there's an organization called the Veterans Association. A lot of people think they're just a food bank, but that's not so. They're a full support association. They basically do what the government should be doing. Like they shouldn't even have to exist, but they do. And if you haven't gotten a call from them yet, they will. And one of the things that they're going to do, Tom, is they're going to review everything that you're getting, that you've been getting, and like make sure that it's you're getting your due.
Honestly, Mark, like a lot of people have been shoot questions at me, asked me about, you know, my pension and stuff. And honestly, I do not know most of the times because it's just everything keeps changing all the time.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a mystery wrapped in an enigma. None of us know for sure. What are we entitled to? Are we getting what we should be getting? And because everything's a fight and everything's hidden, you know, I mean, say, oh, it's right. It's all there on the veterans.gc.ca website. It's all there. Oh, yeah. Good luck finding it and figuring it out and deciphering it. It's all in code. Yeah.
So anyway, I met this guy online through Facebook, and he used to work for Canada Revenue Agency, CRA, but he was also a member of the reservist, and he was a captain. So I talked to him sometimes, and he called me up one day, and he said, Tom, he said, you should try for this IRB, your, what's it called, income replacement benefit. Before, it was called Earnings Loss Benefit, ELB. Mm-hmm. I mean, DVA keeps changing the names like so many friggin' times. So he said, you should get a pension for that. You should get X amount of dollars a month. I said, well, I don't know about that. He said, I think you should apply for it. So I applied. They turned me down. Said I didn't qualify. A few months passed. I got a letter from DVA saying that they reviewed my application again, and I do meet the criteria. You know how much money they gave me back then?
Hmm.
It was called ELB then.
Yep.
$2.82. I said to the lady on the phone, like, are you serious? I said, that's not enough money so I can buy a bag of chips and can of pop for myself. $2.82.
Tommy, did you reach out to John Sr.? Armored John?
Yes, I did.
Have you got a conversation going yet?
No, not yet, but he said he's going to give me a call. So anyway, okay. My IRB went from $2.82 to $282. At the current time right now, my IRB is $437 a month. So to me, the left hand don't know what the right hand is doing. Like, how many years ago now? 4 years ago? I had a letter saying that, you know, they made some miscalculations into my pension from 2002 to 2010, I think it was. And they said that they owed me $49,000. And so it's another one of these cases, Mark, that there is a lack of communication, or like I said, the left hand don't know what the right hand is doing. And once again, I called them up and I said, are you guys sure this is correct that you guys owe me $49,000?
Yeah, because you don't want them to claw it back.
No, because they've been made that many mistakes over the years and miscalculations, and you know as well as I do, there's that many lawsuits on the go, you can't keep up with it. And DVA is always screwing things up.
So I want to, instead of getting into the nuts and bolts, of the different compensations. I know you're like, I'm feeling pretty confident from what I know of the system that you're not being paid correctly. We'll talk about that off air though. And either way, people like John Senior, and the Veterans Association, they'll be able to go through what you're getting. And, I'm almost certain you're getting radically underpaid, but
we'll
deal with that. But one question that I want to ask you, Tom, is that it's been said about yourself, about everybody who's with permanent injuries, you've lost two legs and you've just had your eye removed from that mine strike. Yeah, there she is. And
I don't think Blue Cross believes me that I got my eye removed yet.
Oh, God. So that's what I want to ask you. What's often said, it's even been said in the House of Commons, is that veterans, say for yourself, a double amputee, have been forced to prove that their legs haven't grown back every year. Now, is that true, or is that only a version? What's the truth, Tom?
That is correct. Every year I got to fill out this medical form from CISL about my medical conditions. And sometimes I forget to fill it out because my memory is shot. I got our job, remember what I had yesterday for supper. So sometimes I'll forget to fill this medical doc out for CISL every year, annually. And a couple of times I forgot it, totally forgot, and they will not give me no warning at all. Boom, cut off, just like that.
So they have cut you off because you didn't fill out a piece of paper saying, no, my legs have not grown back. Is that accurate?
Yeah. I don't know if they think I'm a lobster or what. I fucking don't know. Like, seriously, come on.
You don't fill out your stupid piece of paper, they cut you off.
Well, they did. And actually, getting back to this lawsuit that I was involved with, they cut me off for fucking 20 years, my LTD. But now, after the lawsuit, it was all retroactive payments that they owed me for cutting me off for 20 years. Mm-hmm. But after I got my compensation back from the Leave No Vet Behind campaign, holy Jesus, Mark, it was nothing but a fucking nightmare getting my taxes done out. So anyway, the $16,000... or the $17,000 that I owed CISL, that was white clean slate. But the following year after, when I get my taxes done, guess what? I still owed CRA $16,000. So it's just as broad as it is long, you know? When I first rolled over that landmine, like I said, I was 10 years. Before I got compensated, what did they give me? $250,000 lump sum. And talking about lump sum payments, this is another thing that I strongly disagree with, is the new Veterans Charter that the government put in place March the 1st, I think, 2006. In my honest opinion, the only reason why the government decided to do this so they don't have to pay back retroactive payments. And to me, DVA is like a friggin' insurance company.
They are.
We all know how insurance companies work. They don't want to pay out. I was, I'm going to tell you now, I was 29 friggin' years. Almost 30 years now, Mark. I got a report here done up, a 17 page report done up by my psychologist saying that I got severe PTSD. Right? Sorry.
Take your time, buddy.
Severe PTSD, depression, and anxiety. So DVA been, you know, they've been denying me mental health services for almost 30 years now. Shame on the government. Shame on the government. That's all I got to say. And now I'm in a dispute with Blue Cross and VAC over a couple trips I made up to Halifax for my left eye. They denied my pre-approval. So you see, Mark, it's an endless battle fighting these guys all the time. I asked the lady from Blue Cross a couple of times now, every time I talk to them, like, what in the hell is their beef with me? What is their beef with me? Why are they giving me such a hard time all the time? You know? I don't understand it. I got some points jotted down here. When you go on overnight stays, this is what they want. Date and time of your appointment. The doctor's name. Location of the doctor's office. Medical aid, pension, condition you're traveling for. Date you require for overnight accommodations. If you require an escort for this trip, you would also need a note from your doctor explaining why. I give them this information all the time. But for some unknown reason, they comes up with the lame excuse that, what am I going to say there? They keep come up with the lame excuse, not enough information. What other information do they need, Mark? Like, the next surgery that I got to do or whatever, if I got to tell the doctor, take my goddamn cell phone in the operating room and take a picture of me on the operating table? It's almost like they don't, like they don't believe me or something. Like they scrutinizes my travel forms all the time. And, you know, I've been so many heated arguments on the phone with DVA. And I've been used a lot of slick choice of words. Curse words. But what was I supposed to do, Mark? You know? And when I, you know, last time I told them that they should be fucking ashamed of themselves, which they should, just because I said that word, if they came back saying that, you know, Mr. Anderson, you got to refrain from using vulgar language. We're going to investigate you, discontinue your services, yada, yada, yada. But it's very frustrating, very frustrating. I mean, I put 100% into my job as an infantry soldier, as a United Nations peacekeeper. I got blown up on the job, you know. But I did not get 100% back from the government, believe you me. And my Mark, I'm not a guy that expects everything on a silver platter. I'm not like that. But if you're entitled to payable benefits, and if you earn it, and if you're entitled to it, yeah. Why expect to get those benefits? And that's why DVA got these cutoff dates put in place, certain dates. If you go on your VAC account or go on the veterans site right now, after this podcast, whoever's listening, there's a benefit there for critical injury benefit. Critical injury benefit. So I went and looked at it. I fits all the criteria except one thing, and that's the date, March the 1st, 2006, when the government introduced the new Veterans Charter. I fall under the old Pension Act, and that's what the, to me, in my opinion, that's why they put in this new Veterans Charter, because there's cutoff dates. So who gives a fuck what year you got injured? You're injured, you're injured. You know what I'm saying? Do that make sense? I don't, you know?
Yeah, that's it. So that didn't occur to me till you said it, that things like the additional pain and suffering benefit, because you're before 06, they might say no.
I fall under the old Pension Act.
Yeah.
So where I fall is under the old Pension Act. I got my lump sum payment of $250,000, which took 10 years to get. So I got my lump sum payment, $250,000, plus I got my disability pension through VAT, which is good. But when he came out with this new business charter in 2006, any serviceman or woman that goes on a peacekeeping duty and gets say blown up like I did, and correct me if I'm wrong, you'll get a lump sum payment of $360,000, or you can take it out in monthly installments over a period of 25 years, and the government is calling it a pension for life. It's not a pension for life. So you see where this is going to, Mark? DVA, they'll do anything possible to not pay out. And I don't give a fuck about money anymore or benefits anymore. But I just want the services. You know? I just want the services. So my psychologist put a request in to do my reassessment. January 28, 2022, she had to reassess me. April 24th, 2023, I finally got diagnosed with severe PTSD, anxiety, and depression. And then they wonder why I got these mental health issues. Nobody, and I mean nobody, the only guy that came to my parents' house when I was living with my parents at the time after I came home from Ottawa from the National Defense Medical Center was a local guy from Port of Ask. Not going to say his name. He was an Air Force captain. He was like, a transition officer. He was no trained psychiatrist, nor was he a psychologist. Came today, so how are you doing, Tommy boy? You know, how's everything going? Blah, blah, blah. That was it. Other than that, I have not spoken to a trained professional about my accident where I got blown up as a UN peacekeeper over in Croatia, April 24, 1994. Now, can you imagine that?
So,
and then they wonder why I'm disgruntled and I'm a pissed off veteran.
Do you have those services now? Are you seeing a psychologist or a therapist now through VAC?
Not through VAC, no. I got an outside psychologist from Niagara Falls, Ontario. I would never get a psychologist within the government, especially VAC. I do not trust any of those people.
I understand that. Are they covering the bills, though?
Yes, they are.
Okay, so VAC's covering the bill. That's good.
They are covering the bills, yes.
Okay. Finally. Yeah.
So, you know, I went up to Halifax twice. My first trip was several occasions, you know, but the two trips that I got denied for approval, I went up March the 10th, 2023, to have a laser diode surgery done. It didn't work out. It basically burnt my eye to a crisp. So I went back.
What was it supposed to do? What was this laser diode surgery supposed to accomplish?
It's supposed to take the pressure off my left eye.
Okay. So one thing we haven't been clear on with the audience, your left eye, the injured eye, it's been a dead eye since 94, and you just had it removed recently.
They should have taken the eye out years ago, but they never. I don't know why. I was pretty much legally blind in that eye ever since. My retina was severely lacerated, and the retina is what produces the image, so you can see. Also, I don't have a pupil in my left eye, and the pupil controls the amount of light entering your eye. So that's why I always had to wear dark sunglasses because of the light sensitivity. Mm-hmm. So after I got diagnosed with cancer back in May of 2018, I think it was 18 or 19, I started having a lot of troubles with my eye, and I think the chemo and the radiation shaved up the cornea that they first put in. So I had to go back to Halifax, get another corneal transplant put in. I went back and had a glaucoma surgery done, where he puts a stent tube in. That came out, so that's why I had to go back to the laser diode surgery. That didn't work out. So April 19th, they finally done surgery and removed my left eye altogether. And my left eye, it is a service-related injury.
Of course it is.
From the landmine explosion. And when I got my stubs back for my reimbursements, when I looked at it, I was like, geez, like, I should get back more of this. So when me and my wife sat down and sized it up, they denied two of my trips to Halifax for my eye, saying that not enough information. I don't know what else I could do. A few years back, I had the same problems. So I was on the phone having a heated argument with a lady from Blue Cross. She kind of jacked me up on the phone, and she said, "You got to call us first in order to get your trips pre-approved for overnight stays."
Well, that's the problem right there, Tommy. I mean, there should be no pre-approval. It's quite the opposite. It's they should be spotting you instead of you having to go out of pocket and then get reimbursed. First of all, it's just it's absolutely ridiculous. What should be is a credit card that you're given, that whatever medical expenses are required, you just charge it to the credit card. And that's it. No questions asked. That's how it has to be. And I don't know how we're going to get that fixed. I've talked with Aaron O'Toole about this. His idea was a medical access passport, which is the same thing. So it's a credit card from Veterans Affairs, and you just use it for what you need. And that's it. And unless there's a strange charge that isn't medically related that pops up on it, we just have it coded so it only works for medical facilities, and then you're good.
Yeah. So when this first all started to happen a few years back, and the lady kind of jacked me up on the phone, gave me shit, so to speak, and I gave her shit too, obviously. She said, "You got to call Blue Cross first to get your trips pre-approved." I said, "Well, thank you very fucking much for telling me this. How come no one ever explained this to me years ago?" She said, "Yes, you got to call us first and then go on your VAC site and submit all my receipts and whatever." I said, "Okay, fair enough." So from there on in, every appointment, when the doctor calls me and said, "Okay, you got a surgery on such and such date," I picks up the phone right away, Mark. I phones Blue Cross well in advance. And what I mean by well in advance, I always phone them at least, say, like, fucking 4 weeks ahead of time, explaining to them, "Okay, I got to be at this doctor's office on such a day. This is the nature of my business. This is the address, the number of the doctor, the name of the doctor. But to no avail, they still turns me down most times. So when I called Blue Cross back a few days ago, the lady said, you got to call VAC. So I guess on my VAC account, gets in contact with VAC, and then they refers me back to Blue Cross. And to this day, now that's been like almost 2 weeks now that's been going on. Neither department, Blue Cross, nor Veterans Affairs Canada can give me a fucking legitimate reason why them two trips were denied. I don't know.
Because there isn't one, Tommy.
You know,
I mean, for the love of God, it's traumatic enough that you're having an eyeball removed from your damned head. And then for them to fight you and fight you and fight you some more about covering the travel, because there's it's I'm so sorry that this is ongoing battle that you've been dealing with, Tommy.
It's so frustrating. I get so friggin' pissed off and furious about it, Mark. I told my psychologist, like, I feels like walking into a regional DVA office with a fucking baseball bat and trashing the goddamn place. That's how exactly how I feel. And, like, make no wonder. I put a post on Facebook, on social media there probably last week. And I said, I can relate to this. It's like, make no wonder fucking, you know, some veterans goes on a rampage and blows their heads off. Because I feel like doing the same fucking thing lots of times, man. It's unreal. It's just...
The horrific crime that's happening against you, Tommy, is this. You have enough to deal with.
Exactly.
You have enough to deal with. You've lost your legs. You lost an eye in service of your country. That's enough to deal with. But would you agree that it's easier to deal with the loss of your legs than the loss of your eye? That's easier to deal with than it is to deal with the betrayal of Veterans Affairs Canada.
Fucking 100% hands down.
So our traumatized veterans, our injured veterans, are having a harder time with Veterans Affairs Canada, their quality of life is damaged from Veterans Affairs, from the very place that's supposed to be helping them with their quality of life.
It's not a, Mark, it's not a nice feeling to know that the government, basically to me, don't give a rat's ass about the veterans.
It seems to me that there's a couple things that could be true, Tommy. It's either... This is just how bureaucracies are. Bureaucrats, they just want more and more rules because they get off on the power of being able to say yes or no, because that's the only meaning that they have in their lives. So they just love being able to deny until they die because it makes them powerful. So maybe it's as simple as that. It's all it is that the bureaucrats are run amok without oversight. Could be that simple. Or it could be that the system is intentionally set up like this with nothing but roadblocks, like an insurance company, like you're saying earlier, to try to save money. Or the third option is that it's a little bit of both. And I think it's probably the third option.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, to me... Blue Cross, and I can't say anything good about them most times because the way they've been treating me, and as far as I'm concerned, Blue Cross and Veterans Affairs is, to me, is a bunch of goddamn bullies. But I tell you what, I'm not going to stand for it. Not only am I doing this for myself, but for also veterans that's probably in the same friggin' boat as me. So it's time... I'm taking a stand against Blue Cross, and I'm going to tell you one thing for now, Mark. If I knew 100% sure that I had good grounds to take legal action against Blue Cross and Veterans Affairs, I will. Because I had enough of their fucking bullshit.
Well, I'm going to be talking with Valor Law shortly, and she specializes specifically with us and our fights with VAC and whatnot. So Christine Christensen is her name with Valor Law. Another interesting one is Philip Miller. Philip is he's a veteran. He was a Royal. He actually he was on Roto 5, so he took over from us. And okay. now he's a lawyer. And so he was a military lawyer for a while, and he knows the system inside and out. So that's another potential route. But
I'm seriously thinking about it, because somebody's got to stand up and fight against these guys, make a stand. And I'll stand my ground firmly, and I will fucking fight.
So I have a closing question for you, Tom, because I think we've covered most of the bases. You've been in the system for 29 bloody years. From government to government, has anything, was there a good time and a bad time? Has it been equally shit all throughout? Since Trudeau took over, has Veterans Affairs gotten better or worse? Because there's more programs now. Like
worse.
So for you, from your perspective, worse. Worse how?
Yes, sir. Hands down. I like to have 5 minutes in a rubber room with him.
So worse how? What got worse when Trudeau took over? Because there are more programs now.
Well, I mean, like, just the backlogs with everything, with Veterans Affairs waiting. I mean, veterans waiting to get the stuff approved. Yeah. I got one thing I want to bring up here before we cut this short, okay?
Sure.
My side college up in Niagara Falls, Ontario. I'm not going to mention her name because I never got permission to use her name.
Sure.
But anyway, she said to me, she said, Tom, she said, I walked into her office one day and there was a stack of papers by this side. Of veterans being denied, say, their payable benefits, something to do with their pensions. And then she said, stack of papers this side of appeals. So she said the appeals got her attention. So she started looking into it. She asked me, now this is my psychologist, and she got no reason to lie to me. She said, Tom, do you know who Veterans Affairs Canada had hired on a few years back to diagnose servicemen and women for PTSD, anxiety, and depression? I don't know. A gynecologist. Honestly, God.
Oh, my God.
And she went to court on behalf of this veteran, showed the judge who Veterans Affairs had hired on to diagnose servicemen and women with PTSD. When the judge seen it, looked at the paperwork, the judge threw out of court, and she won the case for this veteran, whoever he was. So, I mean, it just goes to show you how shaved up the system is. This, to me, the system is broken. I've been out of the service almost 30 years now, and in my honest opinion, there were some changes, but There's still a lot of improvements to be made by Blue Cross and VAC. And with Blue Cross and VAC, seems like Blue Cross is not allowed to overstep DVA's boundaries, and DVA is seems like not allowed to overstep Blue Cross's boundaries. I put a post on the on social media on the Veterans Advocacy site. And there's some people come out with comments. They haven't got issue with Blue Cross for years. I don't know what I'm doing wrong, because I obviously haven't got very much luck with them when it comes to getting my trips pre-approved. So I had this one guy. He's a veteran advocate, and he said he works closely with Blue Cross and Veterans Affairs. And Blue Cross told him that Blue Cross got a window period, a time frame of 6 weeks to get approved. So if I got to wait 6 weeks for Blue Cross to give me a pre-approved trips, to approve my trips, I would miss all my goddamn medical appointments. Like, come on.
The system is broken, Tommy. And I would say it was built that way. It was built broken.
So my psychologist said to me, where I'm in this dispute now with Blue Cross and DVA, my psychologist told me a couple days ago, she said, Tom, the next time you talk to Blue Cross, ask them, could I get an email confirmation of my pre-approved trips? I said, okay. So I was talking to Blue Cross called me back yesterday. And my trip down to Gander is pre-approved. So I said, can you give me an email confirmation telling me that my trip is pre-approved? No. I said, why not? Blue Cross don't give out emails, notifications. Go figure, eh?
Ridiculous. Tommy, thank you for being on the show today, brother.
Not a problem, Mert. It was nice talking to you. Sorry that I, said a few curse words, but I mean...
No, that's fine. It's fine.
It's beyond frustrating, and I honestly, I don't know what else to do. Like, I gives them all the information, all the particulars about my surgeries and shit. Like, what is their problem? I just don't understand.
Well, I guess you must have hurt somebody's feelings, and they're just not going to let you forget it. That's quite, like, what else? What else do you say, Jesus.
I'm just ridiculous. With the guys having rackets on the phone until I turn blue in the face all the time. Like, my God, like, give me a break.
Tommy, stay on the line, and I'll close her out. Thank you, sure. Thank you so much, brother. And I'm so sorry for what you've been going through the whole fucking time.
I'll still survive. I'm a bit moody and pissed off, but that's to be expected. I'll get over it.
It's all right.
But, I mean, I want to, the reason why, like I said, I want to get on this podcast. I feel like my story has to be told. It's got to be told. I mean, a lot of the public don't know about this shit, what's going on, and I feel like the public has the right to know.
Well, the thing is, it's not a one-off, Tom. I've talked with Brock Blaschek. He's been on the show a couple of times, and Jordy Middick's been on the show, and other guys that have lost one and two legs, and... For Christ's sake, if we can, it's just unbelievable. And the fact that they make you fill out an insulting piece of paper every damned year, and if you don't fill it out, they'll cut you off. That part I didn't know, so thank you for telling me that they'll cut you off if you forget to fill out your damned piece of paper saying that, I have not recovered from my legs being blown off. They have not grown back. Freaking believable. Tom, thanks for being here. Please stay on the line. We'll talk off air. You're listening to Operation Tango Romeo, the Trauma Recovery Podcast for veterans, first responders, and their families. And if you are a worker with Veterans Affairs or Blue Cross, please, I'm begging you to have a heart, put your ego aside. If there's veterans who are calling you names and swearing at you, understand why that is. Understand that there could be years and years, in Tom's case, 29 years of fighting and fighting and fighting. Try to understand where they are coming from and stop putting roadblocks in front of them. That is not what you are there for. You are not the roadblock person. You're supposed to be the supporter. A supporter takes away roadblocks. A supporter takes away the challenges and helps. Putting more challenges in front of somebody isn't helping, it's hurting. And please understand that you are doing more harm than good. You are in a support role. You are in a support role, not in I'm going to hurt this veteran role. But every time you put these roadblocks in front of us, you are causing harm. More harm than what they have suffered from a war injury. Stop it. Do good. Don't do harm. Stop it. Be a supporter. Help. Don't harm. Thank you for joining us. We'll be right back. Hey everybody, it's Operation Tango Romeo, the place where healing happens. If you'd like to support this show, remember, like, comment, subscribe, and share like the sugar bear, because sharing is caring.